Hello and welcome to episode 245 of WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Matt Ballantyne, Chris Weston and Sue Charman Anderson.
Hello everybody and welcome to this latest episode of WB40, where we have another guest, and it is the first WB40 podcast since the WB40 get-together, like the early Christmas event that happened on Friday, if I'm not losing my marbles. Yes, on Friday, and a very splendid event it was too. So if you were there, thank you for coming, and thank you very much to Alex for doing all the organisation, because it would never have happened if somebody like Alex hadn't done that. How are you, Matt? How's your week culminating in that splendid event?
It's been very good, and it was a splendid event. And again, thank you to Alex. It's going to be interesting to see what the body count is at the end of it, because we now know of at least two confirmed cases of COVID which weren't related to the evening, but may mean that other people, who knows? Anyway, but that's all part of the fun these days, isn't it? Other than that, I have been relatively calm at work. So I've been doing some work looking at psychological safety and digging into, in particular, Tom Geraghty's psychological safety toolkit, which has actually, he's done quite a lot of revisions of since I last looked at it a few years ago, and looking at how we can start to be able to foster psychological safety where we've got teams that are coming together at quite short notice and often aren't together for very long as well. So that's been good. And then we also did a workshop with some of executive group looking at relationships and stakeholder management, and just thinking a bit about how we understand how strong the relationships that we have with our clients are. We're still small enough an organisation to be able to think about it in terms of people's first names, as opposed to, you know, when you get into a super big corporate size, nobody really knows anybody other than as a number. And so, yeah, getting the execs just to start to think around how we go about managing relationships. I think particularly, there's two things that are interesting at the moment. One is because the nature of how you build relationships has definitely changed as a result of what's been going on with the world post-pandemic, but it was probably starting to before that as well. And so, you know, thinking about how do you go about building those relationships. And then the other thing is because the company is heading towards an employee buyout, an EBO, so it will become a employee-owned business in 2025. One of the things that the exec are really keen to make sure doesn't happen is that because we are focusing so much on the employee buyout, we don't completely lose sight of the fact that we have no business unless we manage great relationships with our clients. And so how do we make sure that we're keeping that outward focus, even though we're going through an exercise that's quite inward focused, and sort of picking up from experiences of other employee-owned companies that we are talking to, and some of whom are actually clients of ours. And that's definitely something that's been flagged as a bit of a red flag for us. So that's all been really interesting stuff, and a bit of a break from the kind of the day-to-day work that I've been doing for the last few months. So yeah, it's been good. How about you?
It's been a busy week. I've been up and around all sorts of places. In fact, I've just realised that on Wednesday I did a business lunch, an information technology delivery company business lunch, which I suspect was the most likely source of my current COVID status, thinking about it. You know, a room full of people all chattering away. I reckon one of those buggers is to blame. But that was very nice, though. It was very entertaining and quite good fun. And yes, plenty of some time in Birmingham, some time in London, being busy, talking to people, talking to clients, talking to people about this whole Microsoft Power Platform automation and how they're doing it in their business so that we can kind of form our strategy properly. So that's quite interesting. And thank you to those people who I've spoken to so far. I'm continuing to go around and do that.
Have you found people are actually able to do it without it becoming a completely unmanaged behemoth of no code nightmare?
Yes, but also no. Yeah, some people don't tend to go through that. Oh my God, we've unleashed, you know, quite a lot of terror that we didn't realise. And sometimes they've already done that with things like Teams and SharePoint, so they've learned and they've put a bit of governance around it beforehand. But yeah, it's definitely and that's one of the things I'm starting to think about now, is a framework for this stuff, so you get a better chance of getting it right first time.
I do still distinctly remember, although it might be just the fevered imagination, an interview where Satya Nadella was being asked about power platform, and he described it as being like Excel macros on steroids. And I just immediately thought to myself, no, don't tell them that. That's just the worst thing imaginable. But as I say, that just might have been my imagination.
So, Sue, how's your week been before today?
It's been pretty good. For the last kind of 7 days, I've been fighting jet lag. We were in Florida for a week, and, you know, it's only a 5-hour difference, but for some reason, the jet lag was just horrific. Work-wise, just trying to figure out what my job is now, because it's all change. So that's actually been quite, is continuing to be quite an interesting exercise.
Is that because you're stopping doing things that you used to do?
Yes. Well, yes and no, and possibly and also maybe. So for the last 8 years, I've been working full-time on Ada Lovelace Day, which is day celebrating women in science, technology, engineering and maths. And that is coming to an end due to a lack of funding. And, you know, I'd originally been thinking about, okay, you know, I've been self-employed for, gosh, probably 25 years, so maybe I'm going to need to get a job. And that may or may not happen, depending on some other things that are kind of in the pipeline that might or might not work out. So it is a period of what can only be described as extreme uncertainty at the moment, but very interesting uncertainty.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to talk about Ada Lovelace Day in a little while, but we, you know, this issue of what you do when you suddenly have a bit of time on your hands and have the chance to think about what the next move might be, and then, yeah, there are a lot, but there are possible permanent options you can go for, and, you know, apply your trade for an organisation, or you can, you know, when you've been around for a certain amount of time, opportunities kind of present themselves, especially if you, sometimes they just appear, and sometimes you can go out and manufacture them, right? But it's a very interesting time. Matt, you were self-employed, what, for 7 years or something?
Yeah, about that. I kind of initially found it deeply unsettling, and I'd just come out of a really quite unsatisfactory working relationship with a massive, large American software company. And so I was feeling a bit hurt and bruised about all of that as well, coming into working on my own. And I think over time what I realised was the only way to do it was to just experiment and try to spin things up. Because I was never wanting to just become a jobbing contractor. I very purposefully wanted to have clients and do many things of work, as opposed to just a 6-month stint and then a 9-month stint and then a 6-month stint. That was really important to me. So it meant that I put an awful lot of effort into things that didn't turn out, and then miraculously other things would appear as if by magic. But actually it was, I think, more than anything about an exercise in being able to generate as much luck for myself as I possibly could by, you know, writing about things and working out loud and trying some experiments and building things as the kind of the most minimal of viable products to be able to test ideas and get those out there. And those would be the things that maybe sometimes would inspire people to say, oh, you could do something for us maybe. And indeed, this podcast is a result of that 6 and a bit years. And that day, that fateful day in October 2016, when I said to you, as we were both, you know, dusting ourselves down after the madness of the summer of 2016, should we try making a podcast? And you foolishly said yes, and then look at us now.
I must have been at a vulnerable moment.
I know, I'm thinking that you're looking quite vulnerable as well with your COVID status. They might try something else in a minute. Does that relate in any way to how you found recent times, Sue? Is it about trying things and spinning things up and experimenting, or...?
So I think, actually, it's slightly the opposite of that. It's more about, I've spent a lot of time, particularly over the last 3 years because of COVID, having to reinvent what Ada Lovelace Day did and trying different things. And it's been challenging because that has meant a sort of divided focus, which has maybe not always been the best way to move things forward. Whereas now I'm kind of spending a little bit more time kind of really asking myself two key questions. The first of what, which is, what do I want to do more of? And then the second one is, what do I want to do less of? And then how can I, okay, it's three questions. How can I engineer my working life so that I do more of what I love, less of what I hate, and get paid? Because there's plenty of ways to do that and not get paid. The getting paid bit is quite important. So yeah, it's an exercise at the moment in creating enough mental space for myself that I can see a little bit more clearly than perhaps I have recently. I mean, yeah, we can come on to this, but like looking back, I kind of made some whopping big mistakes during COVID that I just at that point did not have the mental clarity to spot them until it was all far too late.
Well, let's get into the next part of the show. We're going to talk about Ada Lovelace Day, and maybe we can hear about some of these egregious mistakes as well as the things that went well.
Before we talk about Ada Lovelace Day, could you give us just a little... I'm sure many of our audience will know about Ada Lovelace, but Sue, could you just give us a little kind of potted history about who she was and why she's inspired you to devote 8 years of your life running a day for her?
So Ada Lovelace was really a computing visionary. She was the daughter of Lord Byron, so we're talking kind of born 1815, grew up to be kind of like schooled in maths and science by her mother, who got in all these professors and really kind of mathematicians at the forefront of their field, people like Augustus de Morgan, to teach her, because she really did not want her daughter to grow up to be like Lord Byron, who was famously described as mad, bad and dangerous to know. When she did grow up, she kind of went through this phase as a child of reading lots of periodicals and getting really excited by inventions. And she was kind of thinking about how could you create a flying machine when she was like 12. And she went on to become very interested in Charles Babbage's computing machine, the analytical engine, which was a mechanical computer that he had designed to produce kind of flawless tables of numbers, so, you know, trig tables, astronomical tables, navigational tables, those sorts of things. And she was introduced to him by Mary Somerville and became obsessed with the analytical engine, and between them they really were right on the precipice of creating a Victorian computing era. And she wrote and published the most elaborate and most complete computer program, or what we would call a computer program now. At that point, it was just like a set of instructions that would run on the analytical engine. And for a lot of people, that makes her the first computer programmer. But for me, what is really exciting about her and her work is her vision of what a computer could do. Babbage was obsessed with perfection. He wanted a way to calculate numbers perfectly with no errors, because he was just offended by the existence of errors in anything, and he was particularly concerned about errors in navigational tables, because that could and did result in loss of life, and that's what he wanted to prevent. Lovelace understood that if the analytical engine could manipulate numbers, it could also manipulate symbols, and if you can manipulate symbols, you can do anything. So she is the one that kind of says, oh, hang on a minute. We could, if we knew the science of harmony, we could actually compose any length of a piece of music, any music, as long or as complicated as you like. It could create graphics. So she's kind of foreseeing the future of computer science a century before computers really get off the ground with the sort of Turing and his paper, you know, Can Machines Think? And he sort of kicks off this whole artificial intelligence field at a, you know, 100 years after she's already asking the questions, like, you know, if we know how to program it, it can do anything. Like, nobody, not even Babbage, really understood what she was saying at the time. No one picks up on that thread and continues it. Babbage never actually finishes designing the analytical engine, and so the whole thing kind of just is lost to history until, you know, Turing rediscovers her work and sort of features Lady Lovelace's objection to the idea that machines could learn to think. So she's really interesting to me because she was a visionary. She was also a very good mathematician. She understood Babbage's designs in a way that probably no one else did. She was absolutely astonishing in her capacity to envision, to sort of like follow a thread through logically to a conclusion that we are still creating nearly 200 years later. We're just getting to the point where computers can create art and music out of whole cloth. So we're just catching up with her in some ways. And of course, the other thing about Ada Lovelace, she was a woman. A lot of people still think that she doesn't deserve to be called the first computer programmer, that she didn't write the program, that she wasn't visionary. So there's a whole kind of thing there about kind of this is an experience that a lot of modern women have on a regular basis, where our, you know, contributions are denied or downplayed. And so for me, I just found her this fascinating figure, and she's got this amazing character. I mean, she really had a lot of self-belief and was perhaps a bit eccentric at times, and she's just fabulous. I love her to bits.
And so that, I mean, an incredible story, and coming at a time with an education that would have been totally atypical, I imagine, for women at that time, to be able to conceptualise something which never physically existed. I mean, that's the bit that completely blows my mind, is to be able to write a programme for a machine that doesn't exist. I have struggled in my career to be able to write programmes for machines that do exist.
Yeah.
To be able to do all of that in the mind is just...
It's astonishing, because especially as Babbage hadn't actually even finished the designs and never did finish the designs. So, you know, she would, when they were working together and she was writing, so she actually was translating a paper that was written by an Italian mathematician called Luigi Manabria. And Charles Wheatstone said to her, you know, why don't you kind of do this translation? And she does it, it's sort of almost in secret, shows it to Babbage. Babbage is, this is amazing. Why don't you add some notes? And then her notes like triple the length of the paper. And it's in these notes where this program and this vision come out. And so as she's working on these notes, she's kind of always referring back to Babbage and saying, oh, can you just explain how this bit works? And on more than one occasion, he's kind of like, oh, could you hang on a minute? Need to go work that out. So there's this sort of amazing exchange between them. They were sending letters several times a day. And there's one where Babbage said, it's almost like an email. And he sends this note back that just says, you were right, requires new variable. And you just think, that is so, that's like almost sort of DM brevity of messaging. So, you know, she's not just working from first principles. She's working from first principles that she has no prior sort of work to lean upon, not even Babbage's at times. She's working entirely theoretically. She can't test, which means she can't iterate because there's no machine to test on. And yet the program that she wrote works. There's like a typo in it, but apart from that, it's absolutely fine. And the vision that she then has about what this machine can do is completely unprecedented. I mean, there's no one else thinking about machines in this way, as these sort of, the idea that you could plug a bunch of inputs into a machine and get an output out that, you know, to quote her, has not been worked out by human head and hands first, was just mind-boggling at the time. There was nothing like it. So, you know, she really is quite an amazing mind. She was so far ahead of her time. And I think that is one of the reasons that I think she makes for a really good figurehead for a day, which is actually about women in science, technology, engineering and maths, you know, not just about Ada Lovelace. And I think, you know, she's been a very inspiring figure for me, and I think also for a lot of people. There's a lot more small children called Ada now than there used to be.
Yeah, and I guess the other thing that is, I think we're now starting to lift the lid on, is how many women who have been involved in the history of the development of science, technology, in maths, have simply not had their stories told.
Yeah, it's countless. I mean, there's so many. I mean, yeah, for the last few years, you know, during the pandemic, we've not been able to do Ada Lovelace Day in person. So one of the things that we did was this sort of 50-hour content marathon. 50 hours because actually that's the length of a single day on Earth. If you start at midnight in the middle of the Pacific Ocean and go all the way around, it's 50 hours because there's a kink in the international dateline. So that's 50 blog posts about women in STEM, about books and podcasts and organizations supporting women in STEM. But just the number of stories of women where it's kind of like, this woman did something really, really amazing and then was forgotten and no one found out about it for 50 years. This woman did something really amazing and then some bloke came along and took credit for her work. I mean, it's just, there's so many women that have just been completely underappreciated and quite often completely written out of the history books. And, part of our remit is really to try and tell those stories and get a little bit of recognition for those women. Because we wouldn't be where we are now if it weren't for all of the women who've been labouring quietly in the background just getting stuff done.
And of course, without those role models, the challenge of being able to get more diversity in the breadth of science, technology, engineering and maths is so much harder.
The problem is you can't be what you can't see. And the issue of role models is so important, particularly for girls and women, because role models provide evidence to girls and women that success is possible. And that is more important for women than it is for men. And actually, that was a piece of research by psychologist Penelope Lockwood that actually inspired Ada Lovelace Day in the first place. And I sort of was reading that back in 2008. And then the first Ada Lovelace Day was March 2009. And the whole idea was, let's talk about women in STEM, let's create some new role models, let's inspire women to pursue a STEM career, let's inspire girls to study STEM. And and that's what Ada Lovelace Day has really been about.
So how did it evolve from those early ideas and this obvious passion that you have about being able to extend out the breadth of the people that we have in these industries? How did it start? What did it turn into? What has it turned into?
So it really started because I was going to a lot of tech conferences and not seeing very many women on stage. And in one extremely memorable occasion, being literally the only woman, not just on stage, but in the entire room of about 100 people. And that's actually quite an isolating experience. So you are the only woman in a room of 100. That's like, well, who do I go and talk to over coffee? There was a whole load of us blogging. This was back when blogging was still a thing. Talking to each other about, oh, here's another conference with hardly any women speaking or no women speaking. And we'd try and challenge the organisers and, there'd be all sorts of excuses. We asked all the women, they all said no. We couldn't find any women. Or, my favourite was, well, there aren't any women. And it's like, I think you'll find there are. And that was the real sort of impetus originally, was like, if we start talking about women in tech and what they're doing, then these conference organisers won't have any excuses because we'll be able to point to all these blog posts and say, there you go. Here are your women in tech, off you go. And so that originally it was a day of blogging for women in tech, but it pretty much immediately turned into a day celebrating women in STEM because people were immediately talking about Marie Curie and Florence Nightingale and, these figures that we've all heard of. And then as it developed, we started to see people talking about, more niche figures that, maybe it would be their teacher or one of their colleagues or their mum. And so that was quite nice to sort of make sure and to see that it wasn't just the big names that were being celebrated, it was everybody. And then as the years went on and blogging became a bit less fashionable, it sort of moved into an events space. So people started putting on their own events. We started doing Ada Lovelace Day Live, which was, I like to sort of call a sort of STEM cabaret. And we'd get 7 women on stage to talk about their work. And, it would be a fun, entertaining evening out that just happened to be, all women speaking. So, it really has always been about trying to make this fun and entertaining and engaging. I don't want it to be sort of preachy and finger waggy. We were always the interesting, fun place for women in STEM where, you know, I really wanted to get into that whole kind of just, it's a celebration. It is a joyous occasion. And that was always our focus, was to try and achieve that, whether it was in person or online.
I mean, it just seemed to me like Ada Lovelace Day itself will always be Ada Lovelace Day, right? It's not going to stop being Ada Lovelace Day now. You kind of kicked it off. And I guess there were other groups in different parts of the world that took up the baton and held their events at the same time, right?
Yeah, so we've had hundreds of independently organised events around the world. I mean, literally on every major inhabited continent, you know, and obviously there's been a lot more in sort of like Europe and North America, but we've had events across Africa, India, you know, Australia, New Zealand, Antarctica 1 year, South America 1 year. One organiser organised 60 events around Mexico City. And I was like, I have enough time trouble doing one event. You know, the idea of doing 60 is like, yeah, you need a round of applause, definitely. So it really took off and became a bit of a movement all by itself, which is really great because it does mean that it will continue no matter what, but also slightly problematic in so far as people then forgot that there was a person and an organisation in the middle of it actually organising stuff and trying to like keep everything going and creating this like central hub of activity. And I think, you know, I'm not the world's best self-promoter, and so, you know, I tended to get quite caught up in just like doing the job and getting the event sorted out and all of our online presence and all the rest of it, and maybe didn't make enough noise about the fact that, you know, there's someone here organising this and that you should be aware of. So, you know, it's been the organic growth of it has been fantastic, but it's also been slightly frustrating at times because sometimes it has been, particularly you see like really big companies getting engaged in Ada Lovelace Day and, you know, they don't necessarily link back, they don't add their events to our map, they don't necessarily engage with the wider community, and that side of it has been frustrating.
And how do you think, in terms of, are there other events or other similar, I'm trying to think of the right word really, kind of days for visibility is a particularly clumsy way of saying it, but that have done that, or is it something that's going to be very hard to do? It seems to me that people, once you spark an idea, they will kind of almost naturally take it off and sort of run away with it. Have you seen any good examples of how it's been done and kept that sort of central?
It's interesting because I think, you know, I'm not against, obviously not against people doing their own thing. I think it's fantastic that they do. But I think when you look at organisations like the UN and, you know, the International Women's Day and the sort of UN Day of Girls in Science and all that kind of stuff, they have just so much more in the way of resources that they are able to connect with sort of like the major multinationals, and then and everything sort of like ties back to that kind of central hub. But yeah, they have the resources to do that, and ultimately, you know, that has always been the problem, is that, you know, a good idea will just take off and it will do its own thing, and then if you have the resources you can run and keep up. And if you don't have the resources, you have to just kind of watch it disappear off into the distance. And, you know, from a societal standpoint, it's fantastic when something kind of just takes off like that. And, you know, one of the things I'm proudest of with Ada Lovelace Day is that it reached into countries and communities that are not Anglophone. So, you know, we've had events in places like, you know, Turkey and Albania and so on. And that to me is kind of like, you know, the idea transcends language and it transcends sort of that, you know, Lovelace as a dead white member of the aristocracy. You know, that doesn't matter because the fundamental idea is about celebrating women and women's achievements, and that really is something that is universal, and people from all sorts of different backgrounds and cultures want to do that and they value that. And to me, you know, that's amazing, that's absolutely fantastic. But it is also quite challenging when you get to the point, as I did earlier this year, where you can't I just couldn't raise enough sponsorship to keep the day going. And that was kind of frustrating because I have seen big brands spending a lot of money on their Ada Lovelace Day events. And then they turn around to me and say, well, we don't have any money left for sponsorship. And that was, I'm not going to lie, that was frustrating. You know, and people have literally said, well, you know, we spent 30,000 on our Ada Lovelace Day internal event last year, so we don't have any money left over to sponsor you. And that was a bit of a tongue-biting moment.
Yeah, I can imagine. It's interesting, isn't it? The challenge of being able to, I don't know, get to the point where you're getting the success because large corporates are involved, and then for them not to just run it all on their own terms. Mm. And for them to, well, I mean, there are so many areas, aren't there, where we can see examples where organisations are superficially doing the right thing, but actually not necessarily, you know, making proper impact behind the scenes. If you think about those, well, 14 years since the idea first came about, do you think there has been progress in terms of how people think about diversity, gender diversity within the context of science and technology?
Yeah, I think there's definitely been some progress. And you can kind of see that in, firstly, the number of other organisations that exist now, even just in the UK, that didn't exist 14 years ago. You know, when we started, there were a very small number of organisations, people like the Women's Engineering Society, which started in 1919, I think it was, you know, the BCS Women, the British Computing Society's group that was started by Dr. Sue Black. And so you have a sort of like handful of professional organisations that are really looking at gender equality very seriously. But there really wasn't anything that was sort of grassrootsy that was for kind of anybody in any part of STEM, regardless of where you live, what your employment status is, what your educational level is. It just doesn't matter. If you identify as a woman in STEM, you're a woman in STEM. And, you know, Ada Lovelace Day really was the kind of thing that I wished had existed when I was studying geology at university. So it was very much this kind of, you know, open, free for everyone. You know, I didn't want to kind of start trying to charge membership or what have you, because, you know, it's like the mission is too big for that. You know, it's too important to try and clamp it down with, you know, membership dues and that kind of thing, which then means that you're reliant on companies to do the right thing. And for a lot of companies, I definitely see some movement. I don't think it's enough, and I don't think it's always in the right direction. I think, you know, it's very tempting for businesses to want to control the process, and that doesn't always end well. So then you end up with things like the EDF Energy campaign, where they had a competition for girls in STEM, and I think ended up actually opening it up to boys and then gave the prize to a boy, which was like, well, what was the point then? And the whole kind of Pretty Curious campaign was all quite painful as well. So, you know, you see, you know, the intention may be there, and I'm not going to second guess their intentions, but the execution is lacking some finesse, but mostly it's lacking engagement with the grassroots. And so, you know, yes, there's definitely been some progress, but there is so much more progress that we need to make before we actually start genuinely changing. But this is cultural change. Cultural change always takes a long time. So I'm not surprised, and I'm not disappointed, because that's kind of my expectation, that when you are trying to change the way people do things and the way people think about things, it just takes persistence, and it just takes this kind of just keeping at it and trying to just kind of hammer it home year after year.
And do you think in that 14 years you'd have seen the transition from Gen Z coming through or millennials coming through? So we've kind of got those two labelled generations of new generations into the workplace for us crusty old Gen Xers. And do you think, or do you see from where you've experienced this, a difference in attitude at a generational level about you know, who should be working in what sectors, or even if there should be, you know, definition of who should be working in what sectors.
So I think you have two opposing forces. You have a much more open and accepting generation coming up, but you have a much more defined and stereotypical environment in which they have to live. So when I was growing up, toys were toys, pens were pens, balloons were balloons, books were books. Now you have toys that are very strictly segregated between boys' toys and girls' toys. You've got girls' balloons and boys' balloons, and girls' duvet sets and boys' duvet sets, and girls' pens and boys' pens. And that creates this horrific binary that makes people feel more shoehorned in than ever, and makes it harder for both girls and boys to be who they really are. And that is really down to somebody at some point in a marketing department realize that if you split things up by gender, then parents have to buy stuff twice, because it's harder to hand stuff down from, you know, your son to your daughter, or your daughter to your son, because, oh, you know, it's the wrong color. And so I think that the gender binary, the gender stereotypes that children and teens and young adults have to deal with now are so much worse than they were when we were growing up. Just so much worse. I mean, you can't go into a shop without seeing something that's blue and something that's pink. And that really disappoints me, because I think then what happens is that the progress that we made fighting against gender stereotypes evaporates, because suddenly you have so much more work to do when the start line has been moved back by this kind of enforcement of gender stereotypes. And so then you end up with gender attitudes that are even more entrenched than they were when I was a kid. And so I don't know any progress we've made through certain kind of bits of generational progress is somewhat counteracted, if not completely counteracted, by a much more difficult and challenging broader environment that we are all living in now. You know, the gender binary has become so much more binary, and that is really difficult for anybody who doesn't fit stereotypes, for one, but also just for anybody who is actually kind of like happy in the stereotypes, but still feels that they aren't allowed to do what they love. So it's bad for everybody. There's no one apart from people selling stuff that benefits from this awful genderization of everything.
So Sue, on the basis that, you know, you kicked off this Ada Lovelace Day and ran it for, you know, I guess for the last 8 years of your life, you said, and it's been running for about 14 years. And now, you know, you've had to make the decision to let have it run its course, as much as nobody's going to give you any money anymore, and for the reasons we've discussed. And that's, which is, no, you know, undoubtedly it's a shame, and it's a, you know, but there you've got, you know, you've got something you've created that as you say, will continue to run. What's next now? What do you do with this next? What do you think you'll put your energies to? Because you can't ignore Ada Lovelace Day, right?
Yeah, I mean, Ada Lovelace Day, so it started, like I say, in like 2009 properly, and then I started working on it full-time about 8 years ago, which coincided with a move to the US. My husband and I moved to the Midwest, where it's quite cheap to live, and so I could devote time to it and, you know, earn a really quite modest amount, and that was fine because our expenses were modest. You know, this year, I mean, it's kind of funny how it's all worked out, actually, because this year we moved back to the UK. I got back in mid-April, and it was around that point that I was like, this is not going to work. I kind of had an inkling from the end of last year that we weren't going to get enough money in. I was just waiting for news of a really big grant application that I'd been a part of. And sort of like May, found out that was not going ahead. And so that was kind of like the final nail in the coffin of Ada Lovelace Day as my main focus. But on Ada Lovelace Day, the BBC published an article basically saying, you know, Day for Women in STEM to end. And a bunch of companies got in touch and said, we're really upset to hear this. This is not right. This shouldn't happen. It was suggested that I chat with the Royal Institution. So I kind of have had a couple of meetings with them. I am talking to other organisations, other businesses about what can we do, because we still need Ada Lovelace Day. It's still valuable. The work that we were doing was valuable, but it cannot continue in its current form. And I don't want it to continue in its current form, because it had gotten to a point where I was putting a lot of time and a lot of effort in and not getting much out personally anymore. And so there is this big question now about, okay, I have the time to step back a little bit and rethink things and think about what would be good for Ada Lovelace Day. What would be good for me? What do I want to spend more time doing or not doing? And then how can I create the situation where this all works out? I'm not entirely clear I know what this is. That really remains to be seen. There are still a lot of conversations to have, but there is hope that some agreement or set of agreements could be made to keep Ada Lovelace Day going in some form or another. And I hope that does all come together, because, you know, I've put a lot of my life into Ada Lovelace Day. You know, 14 years is a long time, and I would really love to see it continue. But this is also, you know, it's a gift in a way to have had this break point where I kind of said, right, this is it, it's over, it can't continue. That kind of emotionally has given me a little bit more distance so that I can think about things more clearly, because for the last 3 years especially, I've just been in firefighting mode the whole time. I didn't really have an opportunity to step back and say, well, what are we doing and why? Because at the beginning of the pandemic, all of my sponsors basically were like, well, we don't know what we're doing. Quite understandably, we don't know what we're doing. We need to have a think about this. Can we get back to you later in the year? And so I had to kind of come up with, well, what are we going to do? We can't do stuff in person. You know, I can't leave the country because borders are shut. You know, we can't guarantee that it's going to be possible to have an event in October. So we'll have to do it online. What are we going to do? And I mentioned earlier about mistakes that I made. The first mistake that I made was offering sponsors an online conference. So I had this idea that I would do, because Ada Lovelace Day is global, I would do a global conference. It would run for, gosh, I can't remember how many hours it was now. It was like 28 hours or something. So it would start at 9 a.m. in New Zealand, and then it would run through all the way through to 5 p.m. in Seattle. And we would have speakers every hour, and, you know, people would be able to log in wherever they were. There would be sessions in your daytime. And we ended up with 60 speakers, and it was incredibly intense. And so much of my time went into organizing that. It just made so much more work. You know, Ada Lovelace Day, we're like 7 speakers and a compere one evening. It's all quite simple. Yeah, but I felt I had to ramp up our online work in order to have something that was attractive to sponsors. I did the same in 2021. We did the Finding Ada conference again, but I split it out over 3 days, so it was slightly less exhausting. But it was, again, it was just like, it just took over everything because it was such a big endeavor. And I realized after a conversation with a friend last year that other online conferences that are similar would have a team of like, you know, 6 or 8 people doing it. And I had basically me and a couple of part-time freelancers. And I was like, it's no wonder I'm exhausted all the time. It's no wonder I can't think straight because I'm literally doing six people's jobs right now. And then, of course, I had to do Ada Lovelace Day as well. And so we did panel discussions. We did five in 2020, which like running five panel discussions with four people each over 24 hours just broke me. So again, last year I was like, well, we'll only do three, but even that is a lot. So I ended up in this situation where I was kind of just burning the candle at both ends and swamped with work. Oh, and by the way, I launched a mentoring platform in March 2020, which was incredibly successful, but again, couldn't get companies to commit to it because they weren't committing to anything during a pandemic. And then because I was so swamped with the Finding Ada conference and Ada Lovelace Day, I didn't promote the mentoring as much. So ultimately everything was too much and it all fell in. None of it reached its potential because I just didn't have the time to devote to it. So at the beginning of this year, realizing that the jig was up, I was like, we're going to do Ada Lovelace Day and that is all we're doing. And I'm going to spend the rest of the year working out what's going to happen and working on kind of like the future of Ada Lovelace Day. And then I have this international move to do, which is quite a lot of work by itself. And so, you know, I've ended up at this kind of place now towards the end of the year. I'm like, I finally, like within the last few weeks, I finally have enough space in my head to look back and realise, actually, the Finding Ada conferences, they were a mistake. I shouldn't have done that. I should have focused everything on the mentoring and on Ada Lovelace Day, and I should not have made so much work for myself. And if I'd had a lean year, then so be it. But I could at least then have focused 9 months of the year on the mentoring platform and had more mental space to devote to it. So, you know, I finally got to a point where I have that space, and it's almost like accepting that Ada Lovelace Day as I knew it was over has been a gift. It has been liberating, and it has allowed me to step back and ask, you know, it's all well and good doing stuff for other people all the time, but maybe it's time I ask myself what I want. What do I need? You know, I have spent quite a bit of time over the last several years really sort of monomaniacally kind of focused, with the blinkers on, where I've just been focused on, I must do this, I must do this, I must do this. And I have finally got a moment to myself to go, okay, what does my future look like? And it has been, it continues to be actually just really liberating and really important. And I'm having kind of quite excited thoughts about things that I can do and things that are in my sort of fairly near future, projects that I'm working on now and collaborating on with other organizations, and just kind of thinking, God, why didn't I do this like 3 years ago? it's quite amazing. So I don't regret what's happened at all, in the sense that I know that our online conferences were really good content, all that will kind of be there forever for people to watch and get something out of, so that's great. I don't regret that, but I do look back and think, if I could do the last 3 years again, I'd probably do them differently.
Well, after all that, and all that thinking about what's gone on and what's going to happen in the future, we've just got to think about the next 7 days. And Matt, what's coming up for you?
Well, it's a birthday celebration weekend, because it's that time of year again where it's my birthday and it's my wife's birthday. They're the day after each other. It doesn't mean there won't be a show next week, because I'm taking it off because I need to be celebrating birthdays, and I'm really at an age where I shouldn't just care anymore about it. But as part of that, and also part of my boycotting of the ludicrous charade that is this year's World Cup, I and a few friends are going to be going to watch Hampton and Richmond Borough play Dover Athletic for some top flight, sixth tier action on Saturday, and I'm thoroughly looking forward to it. I've been to a few non-league games in the last year or so, and it's just great fun, because there's none of the pretentious bollocks that surrounds professional football these days at all. And so that's going to be what I'm up to. How about you?
Well, all my plans for this week, which involved tomorrow going to a meeting all day and going to London on Wednesday and whatever it was, it's all come to naught, really, and I shall be sitting in front of the computer whilst I have the strength to do my work from here with the positive COVID result and still ringing in my ears. So that's what I'm going to be doing, Matt, and that's pretty much it. I'll let you know next week if anything changed.
Brilliant. And so how's your week ahead looking?
I have a lot of conversations. I've got so many Zoom calls lined up with all sorts of people, which I'm actually really looking forward to. Thursday is Thanksgiving, American Thanksgiving, so I'll be taking that off and cooking vast amounts of food for myself and my husband. Although he's making the pumpkin pie, so that will be lovely. And then I think trying not to sort of freeze to death in the meantime.
Yeah, something I've never worked out right. So in America, pumpkin pie, end of November. But haven't they destroyed all the pumpkins at Halloween to be able to turn them into pumpkin lanterns? Is there not some sort of supply and demand problem in the US when it comes to pumpkins?
Different kind of pumpkin. Your carving pumpkin is not the same as your pie pumpkin.
That'll explain where I've been going wrong.
Besides, actually, canned pumpkin is the best pumpkin for pumpkin pie.
I mean, this is the place to get all of your culinary tips for Thanksgiving. Well, have a wonderful week. I hope you feel some level of better soon, Mr. Weston.
I hope so. I'm beginning to run out of steam now. Have you noticed?
Yeah, it's been quite evident. But you've made it through. You're a trooper. All good. And so we won't be back next week. We'll be back the week after. We will be by that stage into December. And so it really is the descent into the Christmas festivities by then. So thank you again, Sue, for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And we will be back in a fortnight.
Thank you for listening to WB40. You can find us on the internet at wb40podcast.com, on Twitter at WB40podcast, and on all good podcasting platforms.